Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. A new book by Esme Weizhong Wang is a moving collection of essays excavating the science, treatment, survivorship, and stigmas around schizoaffective disorder. Wang writes, quote, "People speak of schizophrenics as though they were dead, without being dead, gone in the eyes of those around them." By chronicling her involuntary hospitalizations while attending Yale, her fight to live life on her own terms, and the deep ignorance around mental health, the collected schizophrenias point to ways society can do better. Esme Weizhong Wang's collection of essays has earned her the Grey Wolf Nonfiction Prize. She will be at McNally Jackson in Soho this Monday, or you can catch her at Books Are Magic in Brooklyn on Tuesday. Esme, welcome to All of It.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we appreciate you and appreciate your this collection of essays. It's really illuminating, and you're very candid and very honest, and also quite good at the scholarly part as well. But I actually want to separate the interview kind of into two parts. I want to talk about your personal story and then go a little bit more into some of the journalism and research you did. So when you were very young, you noticed your brain might work in a different way. What were you noticing?
Right. So I think my earliest memory of having some issues was when I was about 5 or 6. I was in bed. I realized I needed to go to the bathroom. So I got up and I went to urinate. And then I decided I was thirsty. So I went to the kitchen and I got some water. Then I got back into bed. I thought, I need to go to the bathroom again. So I got up and went to the bathroom again. Then I thought, I am thirsty. So then I went and had some more water. And I did this over and over and over again. And finally, I just stood at the top of the stairs and I just burst into tears. I mean, I had done this for half an hour, maybe more, and I was just unable to stop. And my mother asked me, what is wrong? And I just wailed, I cannot stop. And that was kind of the beginning of some behavior that may have indicated that something was a little bit off with the way I was behaving and what was going on inside my mind.
Early on, what did people think was going on with you?
There was something off. I know that sounds a little bit vague, but something that I've discovered both in my experience as a lab manager and a researcher at the Stanford Psychology Department and Department of Psychiatry is that diagnoses are not as clean cut as they may seem. Often people have diagnoses, multiple diagnoses. I find that multiple diagnoses are more common than a singular diagnosis or a single diagnosis. I've been diagnosed with many mental health disorders, and this I find is more common than just one clean-cut diagnosis. So that early story that I just told, that's very common with obsessive-compulsive disorder, and later I had many other experiences that were very similar to obsessive-compulsive disorder, but I also had, you know, later diagnoses of generalized anxiety disorder, clinical depression, then later post-traumatic stress disorder, and then bipolar disorder. And then, you know, this book, The Collected Schizophrenia, really focuses primarily on my primary diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder, bipolar type, but so many diagnoses and so many visits to doctors really got me to that point.
What were your preconceived notions of schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder at the time that you were diagnosed?
So I started to think I might have schizoaffective disorder about 8 years before I was actually diagnosed by my psychiatrist. And I had that sense because I was a psychology major at Stanford. I had studied psychology also at Yale before then. I knew that to have psychotic symptoms outside of a mood episode meant that it was very likely that I had schizoaffective disorder. So I kind of had this floating around in my mind. I had brought it up with my psychiatrist, but I knew that also she herself knew of the stigma that the schizophrenia is carried. She knew that if she changed my diagnosis officially, it would cause a lot of difficulty, not only for myself, but also in the way that other people would see me. That official diagnosis in my chart would affect the way I was treated by the medical system. It would affect the way I was seen by all sorts of people who might, you know, glimpse that official diagnosis. And it would have even it would even officially affect the way she would see me. And it took a long time before my next psychiatrist finally kind of gave up the ghost, as it were, and decided to say, you know what, I think you really do have schizoaffective disorder.
My guest is Esme Weijun Wang. The name of her book is The Collected Schizophrenias. When did you first start to have hallucinations?
So the very first very clear hallucination I had was when I was taking a shower in the dorm showers at Stanford. And this was after I'd gotten officially kicked out of Yale.
Invited to leave in a not very kind way.
Yes, invited to leave. And so I transferred to Stanford and I was in the dorm showers. And as I was showering, I heard this voice and it was very clear. It was like a voice speaking directly into my ear. I often speak of how effectively hallucinations kidnap the senses, because it really is like someone is standing right there next to you, speaking to you. And I even thought, you know, anyway, so the voice said, "I hate you." And I thought, you know, maybe something's going on with the pipes. Is there something going on with the pipes? Is there something happening where I can hear people speaking on the floor below me, maybe on the floor above me? Is there something happening in the way the shower is designed in which I can hear this? So then I thought about it and I had to kind of use my sense of logic to understand, okay, no, I don't think this is really possible. And then so that was the kind of beginning of it. And in the next couple of weeks, I started to experience other things. I heard women screaming for help outside my window. The first time it happened, again, it was so realistic. So the first time it happened, I actually called 911 because I thought that somebody was being murdered or raped or something outside my window. And the police came and they couldn't find anybody. And this happened over and over again outside my window. I kept hearing women screaming for help. And then this led to other kinds of hallucinations. I saw a corpse with a rotting corpse with maggots coming out of its eyes in the front seat of a car as I was walking through the parking lot. All kinds of hallucinations started happening, and that's when I started to think, okay, well, this is really an experience that's going on, and that kind of kicked it all off.
Was there anything that ever triggered the hallucinations?
It's very common to say that these kinds of things can be kicked off by stress. Mm-hmm. I always kind of laugh when my psychiatrist mentioned this because, you know, we're all undergoing stress at any given time during our lives. Whenever my psychiatrist asks, you know, "Are you going through any more stress at, you know, right now?" I always say, "Well, you know, yes, because, you know,
the world is stressful.
We live in the world, and, you know, especially now, there's always, you know, particularly stress under this current political climate." But I really don't know. There's also this theory, the diathesis stress model, where there's this idea that, you know, you might have a genetic predisposition and then, you know, your illness might lay dormant until a stressor kicks it off, and then the illness kind of rises to the surface, and then it really kind of gets going there. But no, I don't really know. Hmm. I can point to so many things that might have kicked it off, but I can't really say for sure.
My guest is Esme Weizhong Wang. The name of her book is The Collected Schizophrenias. She'll be at McNally Jackson on Soho on Monday and Books Are Magic on Tuesday. There's something I found really interesting, and please correct me or tell me to back up if I'm saying something that's offensive. I really would like you to do that. You describe markers and certain behaviors that are signals to help mental health care professionals that there might be a problem. And one of them is the issue of hygiene. And in the book, though, you describe you're very fashionable. You've got great style and you're really into fashion and you're into makeup, but you also did have hygiene issues at one point. Can you talk about the dichotomy of being able to take care of yourself in one way, the external part, versus not being able, while you weren't taking care of some basic functions?
I mean, to be completely honest, hygiene is something that I still kind of struggle with. You know, I still can put on a good face. I still put on makeup. I still dress well. But the hygiene thing is kind of something that's an ongoing issue. Mm-hmm. I still continue to find it tough. This is not an uncommon thing for people who have some form of the schizophrenias. And so, you know, I continue to work on this with my therapist. But these are things that are seemingly contradictory or seemingly oxymoronic. But I don't really have a good answer for that. I find it another one of those contradictions that make up who I am.
You write very clearly about involuntary hospitalization and the loss of autonomy. And there are many things that I'm not sure people really understand or think about when somebody is admitted to a hospital against their will or without knowing. Mm-hmm. People suddenly show up because they've been called to take someone's allegedly to a better place. Would you mind reading from page 39 in your book about this experience?
Sure. Hold on one second. Okay. It is hard to convey the horror of being involuntarily committed. First, there's the terrifying experience of forcibly being put in a small place from which you're not allowed to leave. You're also not allowed to know how long you'll be there because no one knows how long you'll be there. You don't have the things that you love with you, your journal, the bracelet your grandmother gave you, your favorite socks, your teddy bear. There are no computers. In the hospitals where I've stayed, the only phones allowed were the landlines, which could be used at certain times of day for a certain period, causing patients to jockey for position by the phones and to bicker over who'd been taking too long. Sometimes, someone will be allowed to bring you something you cherish to you. During visiting hours, although this must take place after a nurse inspects the goods, a lot of the time, your possessions won't be permitted into the ward because they include a sharp point, or a wire coil, or a dangerous piece of cloth. You're not allowed to choose what you eat, and within the limited choices that do exist, you're forced to choose only between things that are disgusting. You are told when to sleep and when to wake up. If you spend too much time in your bedroom, it indicates that you're being antisocial. If you do sit in the common areas but don't interact with the other patients, you're probably depressed or overly inward or perhaps even catatonic. Humans may all be ciphers to one another, but people with mental illness are particularly opaque because of their broken brains. We cannot be trusted about anything, including our own experiences.
My guest is Esme Weizhong Wang. The name of her book is The Collected Schizophrenias. Something you take on head on in this book are some of the really some of the bigotry around mental health and some of the stigmas and some of the unhelpful stories and associations we make. And one you really take on is the idea that schizophrenia is some sort of gateway or conduit to creativity or to brilliance. Why did you really want to tackle that in the book? It comes up again and again.
Yeah, it's funny. I kind of circle around that idea because I think it's funny because it's one of those stereotypes or ideas that is not necessarily inherently dangerous. It's certainly not like thinking that all schizophrenics are murderers, but it is dangerous in its own way. I think it tends to overwhelm the idea that people who have some form of the schizophrenia are often suffering a great deal. And there is no, in my opinion, there is no amount of art that that is worth that amount of suffering. I find it hard to think that the deep, deep, visceral suffering that I've experienced, or that I'm sure so many other people have experienced, I know that in some ways they have maybe tangentially produced some kind of art, but not in the moment generally. And I also want to make sure that in this book, I've done my best to try and indicate and describe just how bad the psychic torture of this kind of suffering is. It's not just something to be romanticized in order to give the world some form of art.
The name of the book is The Collected Schizophrenias. It's the winner of the Gray Wolf Prize, nonfiction prize. Esme will be at McNally Jackson in Soho on Monday and at Books Are Magic on Tuesday the 19th. Esme, thank you so much for this illuminating book, and I love speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with WNYC's culture editor, Charlie Herman.